In the late 1960s, or perhaps the early 70s, there was a researcher by the name of Walter Miskell, and he was associated with Stanford and did research under their guidance. This particular study that he conducted actually involved children. And what he would do is bring a child in, and in front of the child, a marshmallow would be placed. The researcher would then say, I've got to leave the room for about 15 minutes. Now, you can eat this marshmallow if you want to. But if you don't eat it, when you come back, I'll give you two marshmallows. And the researcher would leave the room, be gone. And some kids immediately scarfed the marshmallow. Just as soon as the door closed, the marshmallow was in the mouth. There are others, though, that really exercised discipline. They would kick the table to try to take their mind off of it. Researchers say that some of them actually petted the marshmallow like it was a small animal, trying to, I guess, console themselves with it. But the point of this research was to actually look and see what would happen years on down the line. And so they followed these children on into their adolescence and into their adulthood. And they found that the ones who did not eat the marshmallow had higher SAT scores. They found that their body mass index was actually smaller. And in many ways, exercised a great deal of success within their lives. Now, as most any research done in the 60s, it has been brought under a certain amount of scrutiny. But nonetheless, there was a lesson there. And the lesson the researchers found was that where self-control is involved, typically, if a child has mastered that in youth, the child's life is going to be much better. And that's all well and good when we talk about research of that area. But when we start talking about more important things, such as our relationship with God, we understand that self-control is essential. I came across a definition that I really liked, and I want to share that with you. This was written by Jerry Bridges in his book, The Practice of Godliness. And he defined self-control in this way, the exercise of inner strength under the direction of sound judgment that enables us to do, think, and say the things that are pleasing to God. It's one thing to be able to control yourself when it comes to eating something. It is another thing when it comes to exercising a self-control in life that is going to make us partakers of the divine nature. And thus, as we consider our theme for this year and this topic in relation to that, this morning I want us to explore this idea of self-control. As we think about that in relation not only to how we control, but the promises that God has made. And I think for Christians who struggle in this area, this morning there is reason to take heart. And it's to understand that we are not alone within this battle. And thus, as we try to make ourselves even more of a partaker of the divine nature, I hope that the thoughts we present this morning will be beneficial in that. Let's go ahead and begin with an idea that needs to be stated from the get-go about self-control, and that is, it's hard. You'll notice that in the title here, an agonizing proposition, there's a reason I've got that word somewhat in italics there. And it's because when we think about the word agonize, we usually put that in a negative connotation. We might say, well, she had an agonizing decision to make. And with that, we're saying that it was a painful choice. It was something that was very hard. But I want us to understand that it's not always a negative thing. In fact, consider a verse with me that Jesus spoke in Luke chapter 13 when he told us, strive to enter through the narrow gate. For many, I tell you, will seek to enter and will not be able to. I have established firmly by now that I am not a language expert by any means. But I need to show you something here. When we go back to the Greek word for this, I want you to note what that Greek word looks like. It doesn't take a scholar to figure out a comparison, does it? Because in that word, the very first part of it is our word, agonize. Now look at the definition. To strongly, as in an athletic contest or warfare, contending as with an adversary. So if we look at the word Jesus is saying here, pretty much what he's saying is this: agonize over entering through the narrow gate. What he's saying to us is that this is hard. We're not talking about something that's easy to do. We're not talking about something that everybody will kind of stumble into before long. What he's saying is that when it comes to the idea of striving, the idea of agonizing, you've got to have your mind made up that this is what you desire. Now, what I'd like for us to do is to take a few minutes this morning and to look at three passages. I believe there's actually eight in the New Testament that use this word agonize in the sense that we're talking about this morning. But I've chosen three of those to look at because of their association or their correlation with the idea of self-control. So let's keep this in mind. The first one's going to be very easy to see the connection as we look at the passage that Chris read to us a little bit earlier. When the apostle says to the Corinthians, "And everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. Now those do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown." That word "compete" is our word agonize. The same one that we looked at when Jesus said, "Strive to enter through the narrow gate." The apostle is saying, "Agonize for the prize that's before you." But I want us to look at the other term that's associated with this also. And it's the idea of temperance. Another word that comes from that family of words with self-control. And here we find the idea being, the apostle telling us, is that this is something that is not fun, but it's essential. Let's talk about Paul's illustration here for just a minute. As he oftentimes does, he brings in the world of athletics. And so here he's talking about someone who is striving for the prize, someone who's competing for that perishable crown. Think about that in relation to an athlete. And I'm not talking about someone who just does a Saturday pickup game. I'm not even talking about somebody necessarily in high school who's pretty good at a sport. I'm talking about an athlete in the truest sense of the term. Maybe we think about someone who competes in the Olympic Games. For them, the competition, the sport, is not fun because they know the work that it takes to win. One of the things I've heard over the years, maybe there's a student I've had or someone I know, and they go off to college on an athletic scholarship. And a year or two in it, they drop the sport. And the answer is almost 100% the same. Somebody will ask, "Well, why aren't you playing that anymore?" And they'll say, "Well, when I got into college, it just became a job." Yeah, that's right. Because the team, the college, paid you to be on that team, maybe $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, because the college wants to win. They want their name to be in the win column. And so here is someone who had an interest in athletics, who enjoyed the fun of the game. They go to college. They understand that if you are going to compete, every part of your life has got to be moderated by temperance. What you eat, when you go to bed, the people who you're with, the amount of practice that you're putting in. Now, isn't that a perfect illustration? Because when we think about winning that imperishable crown, the way of getting there is not fun. This is not something where we say, this is going to be great fun, great joy in the sense of having all these good times and being a Christian. That is not it. Because like that athlete, every part of life has got to be brought under control. Who we're with, the amount of time we spend practicing, studying, doing godly things, refraining from the things that will harm us. And that's why we find so many people who abandon Christianity, because they get into it and there's the initial excitement and the initial enthusiasm. But then when the hard work of Christianity comes about, someone says, "Well, this isn't fun anymore." And thus they leave. Here is where the apostle is saying, agonize over this. Realize that you're striving like in a competition or warfare. You're competing to win this crown. Well, let's look at another illustration of this. Consider what we find in 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 12, where the apostle says, fight the good fight of the faith. Here's our word again. Agonize over this fight of the faith. And when we're talking about the faith, we're talking about a series of beliefs. We're talking about Christianity as a whole with all of its requirements. The apostle says, agonize over this. Now, we don't have exactly the same idea that we did in 1 Corinthians 9 with such a clear-cut combination of agonizing and self-control. But I think the idea is still here. When the apostle says, take hold of eternal life, once again, here's our idea of self-control. It means fighting by the right standards. What does a serious athlete do? He reads rule book. He knows the game. He knows what he's got to do. When we are fighting the good fight of faith, we're fighting by the right standards. We're going to see here in just a little while about trying to take the shortcuts and the dangers of that. But here the apostle is saying, you go by what God has told you. Now, keep that in mind, and let's look at how Paul illustrated that himself. We go to 2 Timothy this time, to the end of Paul's life. Here's our word once again, I have fought. He's looking back. He knows death is near. He understands that he's about to get that crown. And he says, I have agonized over what I've done. I have striven. I have been moderate. I have shown temperance in all of this. And he says, I have kept the faith. Once again, there's our concept of self-control. I have lived by those standards. So you put our passages together, he tells Timothy, fight the good fight. The apostle says, I have fought that good fight. He tells Timothy, you preach the right standards. He says, I have lived by those standards. And thus we understand the combination that we find here where temperance, self-control is necessary if we are going to agonize as God calls us to do. So what's our temptation to abandon this? Well, it comes in several forms. And we understand that any time there is agony over something, it's because there's something in opposition. Let's go back to our illustration. Here's the lady who's sitting there, and we say she's got an agonizing decision to make. That means that there is something that's opposing something else. She's got to make the right choice. She's got to choose the right standard to go by. Thus, when we think about self-control and that agonizing that we must do, there are those who are against us in that, who are causing that agony to occur. We know who the chief is in that, don't we? We understand that Satan is very much against us. He's the one who causes these problems for us. We think back to the garden. We know this. Here is Eve, and she's in the garden, and the serpent slithers up, and he says, has God told you not to eat from this tree? And she says, well, in the day that we eat of it, we'll surely die. And Satan says, you'll not surely die. And he convinces her. And it's so intriguing to look at the thought process of Eve. So when she saw that it was good for food and pleasant for the eye and desired to be like God, she took and she partook of it and gave to her husband also. What was Satan seeking to do? He was seeking to make a shortcut. A few weeks ago, we talked about the tree of knowledge of good and evil and how that it represents the idea of a lesson, a good tree to teach that you must listen to God. You must trust that God knows what He's talking about. Eve chose not to do that, and Satan has been doing the same thing to humankind ever since. And what we find is that our society is a very willing accomplice to Satan. The temptations that he gives, there are those who will take those temptations and run with them and not only fall to them themselves, but tempt us to fall. And how much we see that living in such a time of instant gratification. You see, that's the enemy of agony. That's the enemy of self-control. The idea that what I want it right now, and I'll have it right now in any possible way that I can. Let me illustrate that point. I'm going to do this very quickly, but let me just show you how that's happening in 2016. How that we see our society being that willing accomplice. Let's think about it in three categories. The outcome that we desire. What's going to happen if we show self-control, if we show that agony, and what happens when we take the shortcut? Perhaps one of the greatest things on our mind right now, just because of everything that's been in the news for the past year and has flared up once again even this week, is that idea of sexual satisfaction. So here is God. He's made man and woman, and He said, I want you to enjoy one another. I want you to have a physical relationship and enjoy that relationship. But that needs to be done in a temperate way, by exercising self-control. And thus God says, what you do is you stay pure until marriage. When you are married, you enter into that covenant with another person, and therefore you exercise that satisfaction that God has given to you. But what happens? We see society, by the beckoning of Satan, come along and tell us, you don't have to wait. You can take a shortcut. Thus, you've got fornication, and maybe even you don't want to marry someone of the opposite sex. It doesn't matter. Maybe you don't want to be the sex you were born as. That doesn't matter. You do whatever makes you happy, whatever brings you satisfaction, go with it. That's the outcome when we don't exercise self-control. When we try to avoid that godly agony that must go with making ourselves temperate in all things. We think about the idea of having peace of mind. Everybody wants that. We see bookshelves lined with doctors who tell us how to be at peace with ourselves. God tells us very easily. He says, have the right relationship with me. That'll bring peace of mind. You may have a horrible life in the physical, but you'll have peace of mind because you know ultimately you're going to get that imperishable crown. What's the shortcut? It's trying to find a way to have peace of mind without God. And look at how many people, by both illegal and legal means, try to find something to be the substitute for God in that peace of mind. I'm going to take this pill, I'm going to drink this particular drink, so that I forget my troubles. That's the point of addiction, isn't it? It's to get away from something. Maybe it starts out with pain pills and you become addicted and you like the feeling, or maybe it's some kind of illegal drug, or maybe it's alcohol. And so we say to ourselves, I'm going to get this peace of mind in a shortcut. How well does that work? You look at somebody who's been taking a shortcut for 30 or 40 years, and you typically will see a line of destruction going behind them. Why? Because they tried to avoid the agonizing, and in the process brought even more pain. We think about something very similar, the idea of contentment. Everyone wants to be content. God says contentment is gained by peace with me. Here is how you gain this peace with God. But what does society tell us? Well, in 2016, it's, well, fill your life with the things you enjoy. Buy the most expensive car. Buy the most expensive house. Buy the most expensive clothes. Spend money you don't have. Go into debt as much as you can. And as long as a credit card will work, use it. And when it won't, apply for another one, because you deserve it. Does that sound like temperance? Does that sound like self-control? That sounds like the devil to me. Where he's saying, let me hide God from you, the true source of peace of mind, so that you are now hidden behind all of these things. We could add one more. We think about a desired outcome of good relationships with others. God says the way you do that is, as far as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Love your neighbor as yourself. What's the shortcut? Demand my way. You'll do things like I tell you to do. You're going to be the person that I want you to be so that I can be happy with you. Now look at all of those illustrations. What do they have in common? The shortcut is easy. The shortcut is the simple way. The shortcut is Eve eating of that tree so that she could have the wisdom of God that she could have gained anyway had she just left the tree alone. And look at the destruction that followed. Thus, you and I have got to learn that. We've got to understand that, that we don't allow these things to happen to us. Well, let's also understand that if we go unrestrained, we become the enemy. It's not just the devil. It's not just society. It's each of us as individuals. If we don't practice that restraint, we become the enemy. We become the house divided. And thus, we find ourselves in very serious trouble. Let's illustrate this by going over to Galatians chapter 5. Turn over there with me, if you will. And I want you to note how this section on the works of the flesh and the fruit of the Spirit, how it actually begins. As we look in verse 16, the apostle says, "But I say, walk by the Spirit, and you will not gratify the desires of the flesh. For the desires of the flesh are against the Spirit, and the desires of the Spirit are against the flesh. For those are opposed to each other to keep you from doing the things you want to do." Here's our point. Here's the apostle saying there are things that are fighting against the spiritual and the spiritual is fighting against the flesh. There's the agony. There's the agonizing. Two very opposite things meeting head to head and one of them's going to win. And the apostle says thus, the flesh is fighting against the Spirit is fighting against the flesh. And his point is, if you don't allow the Spirit to win, there's going to be trouble that follows. That's what he tells us here. As we look on down, we see what happens when the flesh wins. Verse 19, the works of the flesh are evident. Sexual immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, fits of anger, rivalries, dissensions, divisions, envy, drunkenness, orgies, and things like these. When the flesh wins, that's what we're doing. We're taking the shortcuts. Improper sexual satisfaction, improper relationship with God, improper relationship with things that will cause us to lose our reasoning through addictions. But then he says, if you're going to let the Spirit win, then you're going to see that fruit, that love and that joy and that peace, long-suffering, that what? Self-control. We must then understand that it is only when we exercise godly restraint that we'll achieve this goal. Here's where a lot of people get worried. They say, I can't do that. That's impossible for me. Well, let me add something here. We're not alone in this struggle. It is hard. It is difficult. Self-control is not easy. But the problem is we oftentimes feel like that we are alone in exercising self-control. And I tried to write this out in an easy-to-understand way, and it would never work. So let me just write the complicated, or read the complicated. Self-control is not self alone controlling self. You understand what I'm saying? When we exercise self-control, it doesn't mean it's me against myself here. No. God has said, I am with you. And our dilemma occurs when we try to leave God out of the picture of controlling self. Think about that from the passage we just looked at. Self-control is a part of what? The fruit of the Spirit. Walking in step with God. Walking in the way that He tells us to go. He says, this is how you gain self-control. It is a product of that right relationship with Him. I don't know if the Ephesians were having trouble with it. My guess is yes, because everyone does. But the apostle is going to tell them some things that I think are very helpful to us in this idea of remembering that God is on our side. I want us to think about what we find in the book of Ephesians chapter 3. We're picking up with about verse 16 or so. And notice what he says here. He says that according to the riches of His glory, He may grant you to be strengthened with power through His Spirit. Okay, that's a good statement. Strengthened with power through His Spirit. But I want to take just a second here, and I want us to think about that word power in association with the book of Ephesians. Have you ever noticed where the word power is used in other places? in chapter 1, verse 6, finally be strong in the Lord and in the strength of His might. But now let's take it even greater than that. Notice what the apostle tells us in chapter 1, 19, when he says, according to the working of His great might that He worked in Christ when He raised Him from the dead. What the apostle is saying is, the same power that was used to resurrect Jesus Christ is the same power at work to strengthen us in the Spirit of God. Does that encourage you as you think about your struggle? That the one who could defeat death is on your side? And thus he goes further. And he says, you are going to be strengthened in your inner being. That's the self of self-control. The power of God is strengthening us to fight back. But he doesn't stop there. He continues on and he says, so that Christ may dwell in your hearts. He says, when you allow God to aid you by His power, here is the outcome. You will have a life that God says, I will dwell with this person. In other words, you will be in covenant with me. I will be your God and you will be a part of my people. But he doesn't stop there. He continues on and he says that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may have strength to comprehend. He says, here is God at work. The promises God has made is going to make your heart an acceptable dwelling for Christ, and He's going to make you strong enough so that you will not be uprooted by these temptations that come along. But he doesn't stop there. He goes on at the end and he says, now to Him who is able to do far more abundantly than all that we ask or think, according to the power at work within us. Not only is His power there, not only is He building us up on the inward, not only is He preparing our heart for Christ, not only is He making us rooted in His love, He is accomplishing things in us we don't even know need to be accomplished. Can you ask for a greater promise than that? That when it comes to self-control, when you say, I am fighting this and God is on my side, that God will look at the situation and will help us in ways we don't even know. That's why we need God on our side. That's why we don't try to go it alone. How many passages like this one could we find? We think about what Paul told the Colossians. Him we proclaim, warning everyone and teaching everyone with all wisdom, that we may present everyone mature in Christ. For this I toil, struggling with all His energy, that He powerfully works in me. Notice what he told the Philippians. For it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for His good pleasure. Thus, what do we understand? That if we are going to be the person who wins the agonizing fight, we trust in God. He's there. He's fighting for us. And we understand that this is a voluntary thing. Someone says, I'm going to stop, whatever it is. Wakes up and says, this is the day I'm quitting. By noon, they've blown it. God's not going to force us into something we are not willing to really take seriously. Because if God is involved in something, it will be a serious endeavor. Now, with that in mind, let's not think that we have nothing to do here. Let's not think that God is going to take all of this, and if I say, well, I got to control this, and I pray about it, God's just going to take it off the map. No longer a temptation. No, that's not it at all. And so let me return very quickly to some passages that we looked at earlier in the lesson to show that God expects us to work in this. You remember where we said it's God who works in you? You know how Paul prefaced that in Philippians 2? Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now not only as in my presence, but much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who works in you. There's the formula. God at work. Me allowing God to do that work. Me showing that kind of life that says, I am serious about defeating whatever this ungodly action is I'm involved in. We go back to another passage in Galatians chapter 5 where we read the fruit of the Spirit, the works of the flesh. He says, and those who belong to Christ Jesus have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. If we live by the Spirit, let us also keep in step with the Spirit. How do I have the fruit of the Spirit? I'm walking with the Spirit. How do I gain these things? I am showing my fidelity to God. And then perhaps the one that is the best illustration from where we read this morning. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. So I do not run aimlessly. I do not box as one beating the air, but I discipline my body and keep it under control. There it is. Paul says, I trust God. God is involved. I can't do it without God, but it's up to me to keep this body disciplined because that flesh is trying to push back every day. It's trying to say, I don't like this business that you're involved in of being spiritual. Paul says, I keep my body under control lest after preaching to others, I myself should become disqualified. And thus that means for us that it's learning to follow God's directions. Consider what he told to Titus, for the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation for all people, training us, exercise, agony, to renounce ungodliness, to renounce worldly passions, and to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives. God is at work, but I must be at work as well. Jesus set the perfect standard for that. He showed us. He illustrated to us how that in his life here, he trusted the Father and his will was always submissive to the Father's. If the Father said this is what needs to happen, that's what happened. And that's how you and I exercise self-control. Now, with all of that said, I got to take this very personally. I refuse short-term satisfaction. I'll have to very quickly share this little story with you. I don't get into politics in the pulpit, so if you ask me a question about it in the back, I'm going to turn my back to you. But I do get involved with it in my high school government and economics class. We were talking about the current election and one particular candidate's promise for free college tuition. And in my mean old way, I always tell them, there's nothing free. You're going to pay for it. Somebody's going to pay for it. One young man said, well, what if we just go ahead and elect this candidate and allow him to pay for our tuition and then we impeach him once we're out of school? Now, that short-term thinking, he was joking, of course. But that's almost how we approach this sometimes. That we want the short-term. We want what's in front of us and we want it now. We can't be that way. Agonizing means it is a long, hard road. And thus we have to understand as well what it means to fail. You ever noticed in 2 Timothy 3, 1 through 5, where Paul is in one of his lists on all these bad things, what is slap dab in the middle of that list? Here are people who are proud, arrogant, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, heartless, unappeasable, slanderous, without self-control. Brutal. You think God's serious about this business? You think God's serious when He says those who are against me are people who are unrestrained? We've got to come to terms with what it means to fail. But, most importantly, we've got to come to terms with what it means to succeed. And that's why the apostle in 1 Corinthians 9:25 said, those athletes, they compete for a perishable crown. But you and I, for an imperishable. Do you know what it means for you if you agonize through these decisions in your life and by the grace and the help of God, you conquer them? It means an unending victory. The devil is awfully good at clouding that, of saying, why don't you give in and enjoy your life now? After all, you only live once. God says, forget that nonsense and think about the time when you will live forever. And when you and I can come to terms with that, by God's help, we not only can be like Him, we can be with Him. And so I encourage every one of us to seriously consider the things that are temptations to us, because that is one thing we all have in common. There is something that is eating away at us trying to destroy the spiritual side. It may be some of those things that we talked about this morning. It may be fornication. It may be addiction. It may be materialism. It may be a lack of peace of mind. It may be a host of things. But God says, agonize over it. Strive, compete, and by His help, win. So this morning, if you're ready to show Satan whose side you're on, these waters are ready for you. God has said, if you'll come to Me and be buried in those waters, you'll be raised up with your sins washed away, ready now by His help to stand firm and to fight those things that would spiritually destroy you.